Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Patty James, Vice Chair of the Club's Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum and Chair of this program. I'd like to introduce our panelists today. Liz Lipsky, Dr. Lipsky, is a board certified in clinical nutrition and holistic nutrition. She's been working in the field of nutrition, holistic health, herbology, lifestyle management, and relaxation and visualization techniques now and for 30 years. She's director of doctoral studies and educational director at Hawthorne University. She's on the faculty at Saybrook University, the Institute for Functional Medicine, and the Autism Research Institute. She's a member of the Nutrition Advisory Board for the Institute for Functional Medicine, and special advisor to the board of the National Association of Nutrition Professionals. Liz is the author of Digestive Wellness, Leaky Gut Syndrome, and Digestive Wellness for Children. Liz offers mentoring groups for health professionals on clinical and functional nutrition. She's in private practice in Asheville, North Carolina, providing on-site and telephone consultations, and her website is innovativehealing.com. Dr. Len Saputo is a board-certified internist with 40 years of experience. He has pioneered the development of an integrative, holistic, person-centered preventive health care model called Health Medicine. He's founder of the Health Medicine Forum, a nonprofit educational foundation, and the Health Medicine Center in Walnut Creek. Len is a practicing physician, motivational speaker, television and radio personality, and was formerly ranked number one in the world in men's senior tennis by the International Tennis Federation. Ooh. He's author of the highly acclaimed book, A Return to Healing, Radical Healthcare Reform and the Future of Medicine. Dr. Ald, graduated from Johns Hopkins University and Medical School. Further training was done at UC San Diego and Scripps Clinic. He is board-certified gastroenterologist, practicing in private practice in Santa Rosa, California, since 1988. His interests in GI include inflammatory bowel disease and small intestinal function. He is on the Regional Advisory Board for the Crohn's and Colitis Foundation of America, as well as Sonoma County Ostomy Society. After a two-year stint with the Navajo tribe in New Mexico, he became interested in the melding of allopathic, traditional medicine, and other forms of medicine. He feels quite fortunate being voted one of the best doctors in the SF Bay region by other physicians for the last 5 years. He also feels fortunate to be in the remarkable diversity of healthcare providers in the North Bay. So thank you all for joining us here today. Okay, Dr. Lipsky, Liz. So first, what is microflora of the intestinal tract, and why is it important in health and disease?
After the U.S. government and the private groups finished mapping out the human genome, they realized that we have fewer genes than a fruit fly or a carrot. And they were trying to figure out what this was all about. And so the U.S. government is now working on what's called the Human Microbiome Project. Because inside each one of us, we have about 4.5 pounds of microbes, mostly bacteria, that live inside our digestive tract. And they function as an organ on their own, and they regulate our metabolism. They help us maintain good weight. They help regulate cholesterol and triglyceride levels. They make B vitamins and vitamin K for us. And they do a huge amount of work, and it's really kind of where the science is at right now. What we know about these bugs is we have 10 times more microbes in our belly than we have cells in our body. And according to Bonnie Bassler's work at Yale, at Princeton, 99% of the DNA in our body is made from these microbes. And they spend a lot of time talking to our cells and to our genes and saying, hey, buddy, could you do this for me? And what happens is that, so I always think, like, who hosts who, really? If 99% of the DNA in our body is from microbes, bacteria, then they have a huge say in what goes on in our body. And what we know is that when we live a really high-stress lifestyle, when we take antibiotics or birth control pills, or women on a lot of hormone replacement therapy, or we're taking steroid medications, Or staying up too late partying, which doesn't look like this group does too much of that, or drinking too much alcohol, or just or using recreational drugs or smoking cigarettes. It changes this balance of the gut microbiome. And we know, at least from what research indicates right now, is that if you have an infant, and sometime during that infant's life, you disrupt this human microbiome for 2 weeks, it never recovers. It never balances out. Can you think of a time where an infant's gut flora might be impacted for 2 weeks?
Yeah, ear infections.
Ear infection, taking antibiotics for something. And so it's a very interesting study. And what we also know is that taking probiotics or eating probiotic-rich foods helps balance this, and I'll talk about that a little bit later.
Okay, well, thank you. Dr. Ald, what is transit time, why is it important, and what can we do to improve our own transit time?
Basically, I'm going to be talking mainly about the small intestine, be the 15 feet between the stomach and the colon. So transit time in there is around 4 to 6 hours would be the normal transit in the small bowel. Say the other areas would be 60 to 90 minutes out of the stomach, and then the colon is 1 to 3 days, depending upon a lot of things. So lots of things can happen, mainly when you have either rapid transit or slow transit. Rapid transit reduces contact time. Everything that we digest needs to be broken down into the individual components so they can be absorbed. If they're not broken down, obviously, it won't be absorbed. It gets into the colon, partially digested, and the bacteria in the colon have no problem digesting it, and they will ferment it. You can have lots of reasons besides rapid transit that you don't break things down. Lack of enzymes, being the most common. I'm going to talk a little bit about testing of the small bowel. Mainly breath testing, because we're going to get into a condition that goes by the initials SIBO. It's called SIBO, and that'd be small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. If normally there's not much in the way of bacteria in the small bowel compared to the colon. The vast majority is in the colon. If you have slow transit, then it's kind of the analogy that I use is a rapidly running stream versus a slow stream. The slow stream is going to get filled with algae. Their small bowel can do the same thing. It can happen with anti-inflammatories. It can happen with people with diverticula. There's a lot of other reasons besides slow transit that you can get overgrowth. So how do we test it? There's two ways to test it. The most common way would be ingesting a sugar called lactulose. And lactulose cannot be digested by humans. So any digestion of lactulose, you can assume that it's by bacteria. And if you give a human a dose of lactulose and then have them breathe into a bag every 15 minutes for 3, and it can be longer, but usually about 3 hours, the bacterial metabolism will be a fermentation. It'll break the lactulose, and it'll ferment it and release hydrogen. And so you can then pick up the excess hydrogen in the breath. And so the normal would be you don't have any hydrogen on the baseline sample, and anywhere from 2 to 3 or 4 hours, there's nothing, and then you get the big spike when the bacteria in the colon digest it. In the abdomen, if you have bacteria in the small bowel, the bacteria will be able to digest it much earlier. So you'll get the zero baseline, but then you'll get a rise in the small bowel. It'll fall, then you'll get a second rise in the colon. That's how you digest. That's the most common way to do it. There's lots of controversies that we were talking about before, whether they work, whether they don't. If you have rapid transit, you know, it doesn't matter because there's not enough time for it to go through. So there are definitely false negatives and false positives, false negatives being much more common. The other sugar you can use is glucose, which is very rapidly metabolized by humans. And so there should be zero hydrogen because all the glucose should be metabolized and absorbed in the small bowel and never get to the colon bacteria. In SIBO, you'll get a rise of hydrogen from glucose metabolism. Most of the bacteria in the small bowel are oral as opposed to enteric bacteria in the colon. There is a big difference. Liz was mentioning the Genome Project. 15 years ago, we used to quote people a pound and a half of bacteria, because that's all of our definition of the flora, the microflora in the gut, was by culture. If you could culture it, then you knew it was there. And it turns out there are hordes of bacteria that we cannot culture, but DNA and that genome project really set things off. And so we are far more infested than we previously thought.
Okay.
My body was invaded by an alien.
Thank you.
Oh, one last point. You'll read, anybody, when you go look up SIBO, you're going to read about the gold standard being a quantitative culture of bacteria in the small bowel, where you go down and get juice from the small intestine, and you bring it out, and you not only culture it, but you count how many bacteria per ml or per cc. It's a real nice thing. It's only available in high-level research institutions, and there's lots of problems because contamination by going down through the mouth and things like that. So you'll read about it, but it is not available.
All right. Dr. Sputo, please explain leaky gut syndrome.
Anybody here know what it is? A couple people have heard of it. So it's actually exactly what it sounds like. It's leaking intestinal tract. The function of the GI tract, in a kind of a simple overview, is to digest food, to absorb it, and keep the toxins out. But you can eat the best diet in the world, and if you don't digest it, absorb it, keep the toxins out, it doesn't do you any good. And there are a lot of conditions that cause a change in the size of the pores of the intestinal tract. So if you've got nice, tight pores that filter things out, you're going to be able to do the job that the intestinal tract is supposed to do. If you have a leaky gut, meaning that the pores in the gut are too big, and by the way, the pores are spaces between the cells. They're not actually physical holes, but they're spaces between the cells. And there are a lot of situations that cause that to happen. It can come from having just what Liz was talking about. Dysbiosis is what she didn't use that word, but it's basically mean a disordered intestinal ecology. And that those thousands of different species of microbes live in this very complex ecosystem that if it's disturbed in some way causes real problems for us that can cause changes in the pores. That's one of the things that it does. And she's right. If you take one course of antibiotics, it's like looking at a forest and seeing the ecosystem of a forest and seeing how a forest fire comes through, wipes it out, and then you throw out a few seeds and think you're going to have a forest in, you know, a couple of months. You're mistaken. And the gut is much like that. So once you've done that, it takes a long time to restore that balance to be what it should be. So when the pores of the gut are too big, what happens? Now you can't filter out, by virtue of size, large molecules. You can't filter out whole and parts of bacteria. There are good studies showing that whole bacteria translocate or move from the inside of the gut to the inside of the body. And it can't keep out certain toxins that we're exposed to. When that happens, we've got a big load of stuff that's going to the liver because everything that comes from the gut goes to the liver before it gets to the main circulatory system. And there, you have a job of detoxification that becomes enormous if the leak is big enough. And when you have that huge load of toxins coming to the liver, there are at least two phases of detoxification that you should know about, phase one and phase two. The first phase actually takes chemicals that are not so toxic in it, and it oxidizes them so they become free radicals and they become toxic to the body. If there is a nice take-up from the second phase of liver detoxification, which occurs in the liver cell called the Kupffer cell, then what happens is you have an excess of this stuff that you've created that's toxic to begin with but now made much more toxic. And that can spill over into bile and into the body and cause a lot of damage because of its toxicity. The second thing that happens, besides not being able to detoxify well, is all of a sudden you've got a big challenge to the immune system. Now, many of you may not know this, but 60 to 70% of all the immune cells in the human body are where? In the gut. So they're lined up right there, as you'd expect they should be, because the job is what? Is to defend the body against foreign invaders. And where are you going to get more than the GI tract? So two-thirds, roughly, of our immune system is there. And if you start pouring in loads of chemicals or toxins or microbes that shouldn't be there, it's very hard for the body to maintain an order there that gives you an immune system that can respond intelligently, which means just to what it should and not to others. So it sets the stage for autoimmune conditions that can be devastating to the body. And we know in some illnesses, such as Crohn's disease, that people get autoimmune arthritis, or in fact the whole process may be autoimmune as ulcerative colitis. So we're looking at two mechanisms here that are really important to know about. And unfortunately, this is very, very common in people who are in the hospital. In a study that I saw a long time ago, they looked at 19 people that were in an ICU, did intestinal permeability tests, which are what look at measuring the how much of a leaky gut you have, and they found all 19 had it. In people who are really sick, this is a very common problem. And when you have leaky membranes, it's not just the gut. It may be the lung. It may be the skin. It may be any tissue in the body. And there's now much more data that's coming to light in our mainstream literature, but yet it's not introduced itself into the mainstream, which is an issue that I think Patty's going to ask me about, so I won't
no,
get
no,
into
no,
that.
No, 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 no. I just kind of politely, when we hit 5 minutes, kind of wander over the front.
I see.
That's okay. No, please finish your point.
I'm done.
No, you were in the middle of a sentence.
Okay, that's a good segue.
That's a good segue? Okay. All right. Liz, how prevalent are food sensitivities, and how do they affect the digestive tract?
Well, Len was just talking about leaky gut, and one of the reasons why we get food sensitivities is because some of those molecules that pass through into the bloodstream from the gut lumen are food molecules, and they are partially digested. So they get into the bloodstream, and we don't have any digestive enzymes in the bloodstream. There's no way for the cells to break them down or the blood to break them down. So the cells are there going, hey, we need some energy, give us some food. And the bloodstream's going, no can do. So then the immune system starts revving up and going, what's this garbage in the bloodstream? And also when we have a leaky gut, the inside of the gut lumen looks really a lot like a towel. You know how a towel has all those teeny little loops all over it? And those little teeny loops have little teeny threads on top of them, and those are called the villi and the microvilli. And when we have leaky gut, not only do we get large molecules that pass in, but we also get inflammation on those surfaces, and so that inflammation actually prevents absorption. So we get malabsorption, and we end up with food sensitivities and toxins, as Len was discussing. So I find that people who come to see me who have autoimmune conditions, they have fatigue, arthritis, pain in their body. One of the things I do is I do what I call an elimination diet. And I say for 2 weeks, what I want you to do is eat this way. And by the time people come to see me, they're usually willing to do almost anything. I call it like the trapeze act. It's like, will you jump, will you catch this trapeze as it comes to you? Because by the time people call me from across the country, they'll do anything. And so I say, eat this diet for 2 weeks. And it's not a bad diet. Basically, it's fruits, vegetables cooked pretty much any way you want, as long as they don't have sugar or soy or artificial stuff in them. But it's all real food. You can have organic poultry. You can have organic meats. You can have olive oil and ghee and coconut oil and maybe some sunflower oil so that you can make a nice salad dressing with some lemon and oil or stir-fry something. You can have salt and pepper. You can have all kinds of herbs and spices. And grains, non-gluten-containing grains. So rice, millet, quinoa, teff, and people do this, and in 2 weeks, what's so remarkable is kind of the things that you see. And often I'll do a detox at the same time. I'll use a gentle detoxification protein powder that helps upregulate phase one and phase two so that we actually move toxins out of the body and we help the liver to do its work. And it's amazing. I've seen people come back and say, wow, I have so much energy. My irritable bowel syndrome's gone. My arthritis is gone. My depression and anxiety is gone. I just feel better and better. Oh, and by the way, I lost 8 pounds in 2 weeks. It's kind of an amazing diet. And then some people, I say, well, then let's start adding foods back in one at a time, see how you feel, and let's try to find that trigger. And sometimes we'll also do testing. We'll do blood testing to actually look for what foods are triggers. For example, I have a client, she has heartburn. We put her on an elimination diet. She feels great. Then she kind of other foods creep in. And we did a food sensitivity test, and lo and behold, what we found was eggs. Every time she eats any eggs, she gets GERD. So, and it could be almost...
They might not know what GERD is.
Oh, gastroesophageal reflux disease, otherwise known as heartburn. You eat it, it doesn't feel right. And it could be almost any food. It could be oranges or apples or milk or gluten-containing grains that do this. And so food sensitivities are pretty prevalent. And one of the other things people say is brain fog. You know, they just, their energy's not right. They just don't feel good. Their memory doesn't feel right. So I encourage you to just try it for 2 weeks. It's a home self experiment. And if you feel great, let me know. Send me an email.
Okay. Thank you, Liz.
Why is soy bad?
Soy and all the legumes, they have a lot of lectins in them, and the lectins are hard to digest, and some of the starches in there are hard to digest. And so I kind of avoid the bean family for the first couple of weeks just to see, and then we add them in. One of the first foods I like to add back in is lentils or other kinds of beans. They're hard to digest.
Thank you. Dr. Ald, what tests do you use to evaluate people with gastrointestinal symptoms?
Nice, simple question.
We'll pick one then.
The standard would be endoscopy when we look down in the stomach, because then you can look at the esophagus, find out if there's GERD. You can do biopsies for allergies, infections. You know, allergies would be things like gluten, celiac disease, and the small bowel. There's a brand new condition called eosinophilic esophagitis, which is basically an allergy of the esophagus. It's something in our food chain, and we don't know what it is, but it requires a biopsy of the esophagus to find. It was not even heard of 20 years ago, only found in a few infants then. Now it is creeping up. Colonoscopy to evaluate the colon, but once again, I decided digestion is such a huge thing, I'm going to limit it mainly to small bowel. To examine the small bowel, you're mainly, for the most part, you're talking about celiac disease being the most common thing we see. To evaluate for celiac, by the way, the history of celiac is fascinating. In the 2nd century AD, it was the first described by Eratatius of Cappadocia, and he named it celiac disease, which is Greek for abdominal. And it fits perfectly. In 1887, Dr. G figured out it had to be related to a diet. And there's all kinds of guesses. The fats in 1908 and 1924, they thought it was bananas. But World War II led us to the cause. In Holland in 1944, there was no wheat. There was a famine. And all of these people got better. And yet, after the war, wheat came back, they all got sick, and it was a Dr. Dyke that put it together back then. That was the first time that they figured out that wheat was related to celiac disease. A couple different ways to test for celiac disease. The most common would be a blood test. There's a number of antibodies that form. You can get a panel, and this gets too complicated for the IgG and IgA. There's several different subtypes. But if you have an IgA tissue transgluminase, shortened to TTG, and the endomyosial antibody, you have a 99% chance of having celiac disease. We've now, thanks to the Genome Project, isolated the genes. You can get down so you can follow whole kindreds. If you find one, then you can examine the people in that whole family with gene testing and get very specific. The hallmark of the diagnosis be a small bowel biopsy, and you get to see all the little villi, the towel that Liz was talking about with thing. and this actually brings in both my people because I can, it's hard to do. You take that towel, the human small bowel, and you level it out so that you have about 5 cells. You know, you basically flattened it out. You covered 85% of a tennis court. There's that much surface area in the human adult small bowel. And it's just multiplied because of all those villi. But that's what celiac disease does, is you lose all those fingers and you can't absorb anything. And the biopsy shows you that.
Okay, thank you. Len, would you address some of the gaps between mainstream gastroenterology and functional medicine and how we can bridge those gaps?
That's a real challenge. I went to Duke Medical School where I had an hour of nutrition. And I really thought 25 years ago that I knew nutrition. And it wasn't until my wife got sick and I learned a little something about nutrition from Russ Jaffe, who we've been talking about. Mm-hmm. And it kind of blew my mind at what I didn't know. And you look at someone like Liz, who is one of the icons in this field.
Thank you.
She really knows her stuff. She's written a lot of books on it. If I had a question, I'd call you now that I know you for advice on that. So doctors don't get the education that she has the advantage of. We do have programs called Physician Nutrition Specialists, but hardly anybody's taking them. There were, I think, at one point 16 programs that I found. And these would be people who are internists, endocrinologists, or pediatricians who would take 1 or 2 years more of training and come out and know something about nutrition. So the problem is we, not knowing nutrition very well, don't know the nutritional approaches to healthcare. And the problem is with that is that you have to look at a different model. We look at signs and symptoms. We look at pathological findings. And we say, this is IBS. This is Crohn's disease. This is ulcerative colitis and so forth and so on. But in actuality, when you look at it another way, there's only one disease that explains every single disease there is. If your cells are all healthy, sorry, you can't be sick. So the cause of all diseases is malfunctioning cells. Then you look at the pathways that lead to malfunctioning cells, and there are only 4. There are genetic factors. We all accept that. There are psycho-spiritual factors. We know that what we think affects how we how our biochemistry and physiology work in a profound sort of way. And so we know that. The third thing is that if you don't put in the building blocks, the raw materials that your body needs to be able to do its work, you simply can't make product. It's like looking at a car assembly plant and you're short a horn or a steering wheel or a spark plug. The car's not going to work. Nutrition's the same way. If you don't have all the things that you need, and many things we don't know the first thing about, because we've identified so far about 55 essential nutrients that if you're short in, you're going to have some kind of disease that's going to affect you in a meaningful way. And there are probably thousands of others that we just don't have the experience with. So nutrition becomes an incredibly powerful thing to know about, and we aren't trained that way. The fourth thing is if you put something in a cell that shouldn't be there, a microbe, a toxin from the environment, of which we have now 80 or 100,000 new ones, they will all cause illness. So you've got only 4 pathways to make people sick, and nutrition's one of the major ones that we just overlook. And the reason for that is because of Big Pharma. Big Pharma does a lot to tell us, what are you going to learn in medical school? Where's the money come from to teach us? It comes from grants. I just recently got a grant from the National Institutes of Health at UCSF for $5 million. Two of those million are going where? Back to the UCSF people, not to me, to do the study. And this is the way things work. And when you look at the fact that Big Pharma does they spend $90 billion a year on research, and the National Institutes of Health spends $30 billion on research, all of a sudden you've got a powerful organization that doesn't want you to know the first thing about nutrition because it's anti-business for them. If you want to read about it, read my book. I go through all that. I wrote a chapter called The Karma of Big Pharma, and it'll make you sick. It'll make you sick. So is nutrition important? Yes. Are we taught it? No. We overlook it? Yes. Do we know what detoxification is in medical school? We're not taught that. We know how to spell the word, but we don't know what Liz knows about how to do that. And that's not taking anything away from the good doctor here who's doing fantastic things, without which we'd be in real trouble if we really get sick. But what I'd like to see, and the gap I'd like to see closed, is the work that Liz does. Her work in functional medicine with Jeff Bland and like Russ Jaffe, these icons in nutrition who are internists, well, some of them, Russ, an internist to start with, and Jeff, a nutritionist extraordinaire, bring that into the medical profession and start applying that to what we do, and you'll start to see something called healthcare reform, where we're really looking at the bigger picture. And then, of course, there's the business of psycho-spiritual medicine. Where is that? You go to your HMO and try to get something related to that, it ain't going to happen. And that, to me, is the most important part of what we do. Because in my model, I think physical disease is the body's way of expressing psycho-spiritual dysfunction. Now, a lot of people would argue with that. But I've been around for 40 years and have created a model, wrote a book on it, and I'm convinced that that's something that we should be paying attention to at the very least, even if you have this academic approach that says it's our research that we should be spending our time on. But you've got to look at who the hell is doing our research. If people who have a conflict of interest are funding the studies, and you can look this up, there are many articles written on that, the poor doctor in the ICU who's trusting what they're getting from medical research is going to be bitterly disappointed a lot of the time because the stuff is wrong. And when the Office of Technology Assessment looked at that as a single item, they found that the amount of really solid science in our medical research in New England Journal, JAMA, etc., was shockingly low. Shockingly low. So those are some of the differences I see that need to be incorporated. And we need to do it both ways, because I'm not saying that complementary alternative medicine is where the action is. That's part of it. That's only stuff that's not in the mainstream. So that's new things. We need to open up our minds, look at new approaches, which we all do in our research. I mean, research is what? Complementary and alternative approaches to healthcare. And that's what we should be focusing on, is working together to build a bigger paradigm that includes every discipline that's possible, whether it be mainstream medicine or Ayurveda or Chinese medicine or nutrition or energy medicine, which is now getting to be a big thing, infrared light therapy I could talk about for hours. There's a lot of stuff that we need to open our minds up. And this is the problem that we have between the different aspects of who practices what kind of medicine.
Okay. Thank you. Liz, what are probiotics and what do they do?
Well, we've talked about the gut microbiome, and in our digestive system, mainly in our colon, I mean, as Rick was saying, the bulk of the bacteria are in the colon. We have basically the good, bad, and the ugly. Okay, the good are the probiotics. The bad are the microbes that cause diseases. And then we have what are called commensal organisms, which we don't really know what they do, but we're starting to find that actually a lot of them are kind of the balance point or might be the glue that holds everything together. So the probiotics are the good guys. And basically what they are is they're microbes that have specific effects that are beneficial to us, that have been known and studied. And the two biggest groups of these are lactobacilli. So when we eat yogurt, for example, we get Lactobacillus bulgaricus, which a Nobel Prize was won for the work on this in 1904 or 6 by Metchnikoff. He said, you know, these bugs really help, especially babies and elderly people at the two ends of the lifespan, and we know that that's where there's the most turbulence, there's the most fragility. So, and also in yogurt, we have Strep thermophilus. It's a type of strep, but it doesn't cause strep throat. It's actually beneficial for us. And in traditional cultures, people ate foods that had probiotics in them. If you go to a Korean restaurant and they bring you that little plate of pickles, isn't that cool? Or in a Japanese restaurant, we get the pickled ginger. Or you go to a Jewish deli and they've got a thing of new dill pickles, which are fermented cultured pickles that you can make on your counter in a few days. And all cultures had this sauerkraut or fermented fish or what's lox? Lox was cultured salmon. And it's got probiotics, cheeses, wines, beer, when it's traditionally made. These all have beneficial probiotics that are good for us. And in our culture, we don't really eat these foods. You know, what happened was we got very modernized. I'm a baby boomer, and we loved those Swanson TV dinners. They were like miracles when my parents went out for the night. We got to eat those, and they were miracles. But we've since then, we now had microwave foods and now genetically engineered foods. And most people eat foods that come in packages. It's not homemade. We eat 43% of our meals away from home. We don't even know what's in the food. And a lot of people need to eat food that's fast and cheap, and it's not really even food. But the life in food is what gives us life, and most people are eating totally depleted foods that don't have probiotics. You can also take supplemental probiotics. I like to eat probiotics and take them. And Rick was saying that these bad bugs, they come from our mouth. They come from our food, and they come from putting our fingers in our mouth and other things. They come in. So by eating good foods, we help balance them, but also by taking probiotics, we help balance them. And, you know, on a daily basis, you might want to just eat some sauerkraut or have some yogurt or kefir or coconut kefir or kombucha or something like that. Or you might just want to take a probiotic supplement daily. And what I love about probiotics, too, is we used to think that you took them and that they grew there and they stayed there and that they cultured there and then they were there. But no, really what they do is they vacation. They stay for a couple weeks. They spend a lot of money in the local economy. It's really great. And then they leave. We poop them out. And so we need to always have a new supply of probiotics. And the amount, you know, I think we can get what we need mostly from our food. But if we're elderly or we're babies, we might need more. We might need supplemental probiotics. And then if we're sick, we have inflammatory bowel disease or we have small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, we might need more of them. And so we might want to take, if we're, you know, feeling run down or have irritable bowel syndrome, we might want to take 20 to 50 billion colony-forming units a day. If you're on antibiotics, you might want to take 100 billion colony-forming units a day and do that for a few weeks after you stop taking the antibiotics. And there are even studies that are using trillions per day in people with inflammatory bowel disease. And so you want the dose to kind of fit what you're trying to do. And for most of us, you know, taking a probiotic a couple times a week and getting some probiotic-rich foods really going to be what we need.
Thank you. Well, we have two more questions left. These are huge questions, so it's going to be a trick to
answer them.
to answer these and have enough time for question and answers, but we'll try. So, Dr. Ald, in 3.5 minutes or so, please explain how high fructose corn syrup affects the digestive tract.
I asked Patty to put this on.
Yeah.
But echoing one thing about what Liz just said, there's a hypothesis called the sanitation hypothesis, that basically a lot of the diseases we have today are because of refrigeration, because of hand washing, because kids aren't allowed to really be exposed to the bacteria in the dirt and your immune system. We could talk a lot about that, but I'll get to fructose. I'd like to thank Robert Lustig, who's here at UCSF, for raising the flag on fructose. The United States is in a unique position where we use more high fructose corn syrup than anyone else. I didn't realize that Coca-Cola is still made with sucrose, which is table sugar, everywhere except the United States. And it has to do with we have high tariffs on imported sugar, and we have a fair amount of support for corn. You know what I mean.
Yes.
Sucrose, table sugar, is a molecule of glucose. I talk with my hands, I'm sorry. And a molecule of fructose. And glucose, like I said, can be metabolized very quickly by any cell in the human body. Doesn't require it. Fructose can only be metabolized in the liver and can't be metabolized anywhere else. The best analogy I can come up with, imagine a dam across a river fills the lake, and the routine amount of flow through the generators does lots of good things. and there's four metabolic pathways, and two are like that. They're like they handle it without a problem. That lake gets too big, you go over the spillway, all of a sudden you're flipped into the other two pathways. And basically the good pathways create glycogen, which is our storage. The liver's filled with it. It's where we get quick energy for the first hour or two of exercise. This other pathways actually turn a sugar into a fat. And then it goes into triglycerides, which is a major portion of VLDL, which is one of the major fatty acids involved in heart disease and things like that. It'll also store a lot of fat in the liver. And so you end up – high fructose corn syrup is ubiquitous in our culture. And especially kids, if you're growing, you end up with kids with fatty livers. And it is very difficult to get rid of it because when you go off of it, you'll get rid of your glycogen first. The fat is what the body's trying to store for, you know, the disasters over time.
Thank you. That was amazing that you did that in that amount of time.
I just want to say the average person eats about 145 pounds a year of high fructose corn syrup and sucrose.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And the average teen, age boy, 20% of their calories come from high fructose corn syrup from soft drinks alone. The average American gets 17% of their calories from sugar and sweeteners a day.
Yeah, Rob Lustig calls it alcohol without the buzz. Because it causes cirrhosis.
Yeah, the only other sugar that's handled the way fructose is alcohol. And so high fructose corn syrup, just like drinking the beer belly that people get, you know, it's the fructose
there it is.
Belly.
Yeah. Len, you have the last question, and then we'll go to questions and answers. What is antigenic load, and why is it important?
Okay. There are a couple of ways to deal with immune system that's all revved up. So in autoimmune conditions, what you've got is antibodies attacking your own body. There are a couple of ways to deal with that. You can use drugs to kill the immune system, steroids, and you can use anti-cancer drugs, and you'll knock the immune system back. And you'll do some really good things about taking autoimmune conditions and making them quiet. Another way to do the same thing is to do what Russ Jaffe calls lower the antigenic load. That's why I learned that. What that means is you find out what it is that you're sensitive to by doing a variety of immune tests, looking for sensitivities. You skin test and RAS test, looking for IgE antibody, and you can do this ELISA ACT test that Russ Jaffe has invented at Serimmune Labs that looks for delayed hypersensitivities, which we don't look for much in the mainstream, although it's beginning to seep into it. If you can find out what you're sensitive to, will you get the same result if you avoid those substances? That's called lowering those substances, those antigens, that are causing immune reactions. What happens if you remove them? You get the same effect. And that's why I think that's the first thing to try, is to try and find out what you're sensitive to by doing the right tests, and then to withdraw those and see what happens. If it doesn't work, yeah, of course. Do what you have to stop the autoimmune process. That's why Russ Jaffe saved my wife's life. She had a condition called primary anaphylaxis, which means she was having... She had 28 episodes of anaphylaxis where she had to be injected with adrenaline, and a couple of times just nearly bit it. And we put her on steroids and some other drugs to try and suppress the immune reactions, and she got into lots of trouble, and I thought she was going to die from the treatment. Then I met Russ Jaffe through, God knows, thank you, universe, for bringing him to my doorstep. And he said, why don't you try my test? So I'll give it to you for free. We found 41 things, whereas in the mainstream we found zero. We took her to Stanford, to Grand Rounds in immunology, and the answer was to use the drugs because we don't know anything different to try. So we took her off those things. In 3 months, she basically was off the steroids, and today she's well. So that's lowering the antigenic load.
Thank you. Okay, we'll do – Dr. Grand is going to – we'll do about 15 minutes or so of questions. And if you would, ask one question and a one-part question. People, thank you. And we'll let the panelists decide who's going to answer the questions.
Well, I may have to add another part, but you mentioned stress causes problems with digesting the food. How does that work, and how's the diet? What kind of food should I eat to have to remain very healthy so the cells are fed the right food and they'll protect me from bad things coming into my body?
I'll take the stress part if you take the second part. Easiest thing to think about when you're under stress, lots of things happen, but adrenaline is the easiest one to think. Your body's getting ready to fight the mastodon. Well, you need your brain, you need your muscles, but you don't need your gut. And you're going to get a lot of blood flow diverted from your gut, and transit's going to slow down rather dramatically. That's the real short answer.
Yeah, and also the digestive system repairs and replaces itself every 3 to 5 days. And so if we're always in that fight-or-flight mode, then it kind of says, well, the roof of the house is burning, but maybe I won't change those light bulbs by fixing the gut. And so we defer repair, and that's another Russ Jaffe term. Best foods to eat, loads of fruits and vegetables, good quality organic meats, no genetically engineered foods, which means not eating anything that has pretty much soy unless it's organically grown, not eating anything that has cottonseed oil in it or canola oil, not eating any corn product, which means no corn starch, no high fructose corn syrup, no corn at all unless it's organic or unless it says that it's not genetically engineered. I think, you know, Rick was saying that the eosinophilic esophagitis came up about 20 years ago, and that's really when all the genetically engineered foods started coming into our lives, and they're in about 80% of packaged foods. So a good diet, you think about what maybe your great-grandparents ate, except that we have a lot more variety because we get it shipped in. So eating organic foods, eating real foods, cooking at home, or going to restaurants where they actually cook food from scratch, that's really what we're looking at. And then if you have GI issues, then thinking about things like bone broths, because they're really gut healing. They've got a lot of gelatin. They're very alkalizing. They've got chondroitin and glucosamine and all kinds of nutrients that are very healing. Think about when you have the flu, what do you want? Broth. Give me some chicken noodle soup, you know, or chicken and rice soup. That's what we want instinctively when it's inflamed in there. And we also, when it's inflamed, you want really well-cooked foods, maybe even pureed foods, so that your body doesn't have to work so hard to digest everything. Fresh juices, maybe vegetable juices. And I can't say it over and over, more fruits and vegetables, because the anti-inflammatory substances and the antioxidants are all in the colors. Fruits, vegetables, nuts, seeds, and legumes, beans, lentils.
Quick question and a summary statement, I guess. I am a celiac. I have blood tests. I've been through all this. I went through a lot of stuff prior. I had a whole bunch of diagnoses for sinus problems, which all turned out to be wrong. I've done a fair amount of research myself. The question is, there's an awful lot of, as you say, avoidance diets, which I do. And then I also take probiotics, aloe vera, digestive enzymes, vitamins, all this good stuff to try and supplement. I've heard that the owner of the Garden of Life cured himself of Crohn's disease. Has anybody heard of anything for fixing celiacs? And then the last statement is the effects of Monsanto on our food supply and the medical community.
You guys are the experts there.
Do you know?
You want to take the gut specific carbohydrate diet?
Well, the specific carbohydrate diet and the gut and psychology syndrome diet seem to be really gut healing. What I find is that people with celiac, by the time they find that they have celiac, their gut is so inflamed, you know, you can't absorb anything. So you have a lot of other nutritional deficiencies and other food sensitivities. So if you can stay on one of those diets for a couple of years, then hopefully It might just be gluten-containing grains that you'll need to avoid forever. I don't know. The science at this point doesn't seem to have a cure for celiac. They're working on it. They're working on vaccines, and you might want to take this
there's
one.
There's all kinds of interesting things coming, but nothing's ready for prime time yet. And unfortunately, it's still a strict gluten avoidance. Even then, there are resistant celiacs that end up on immunosuppressives, end up on steroids. You know, there are people that are just incredibly sensitive. And is it just gluten? Is it something else in wheat? We don't know.
You might think about doing that ELISA ACT test, because all you need is something on top of what you've got that you're not aware of that could really exacerbate things and keep you from getting better.
Can you tell me, I've been diagnosed with GERD. Can you tell me, does GERD cause constipation?
Typically, no. Both happen to be incredibly common within our population. If you actually are overproducing acid, you'll be more likely to have diarrhea than constipation. There's a bunch of the medicines for GERD that loosen your stools that you could kill two birds with one stone.
You may have more than one thing, you know.
Yeah.
You know, also, GERD is sometimes, it's acid in the wrong place, and sometimes people don't have not enough acid. It's work of Jonathan Wright, and there's some research on that. And you might consider taking some magnesium, because magnesium helps relax everything. It's the mineral. And so sometimes taking a good magnesium glycinate or can really help to with both.
Should magnesium be taken at a certain time of day or with something else like calcium or not?
Not necessarily. Can be taken with food, not with food. It's pretty. But I'd get a good quality magnesium so that you're not just giving yourself a rapid transit time from taking something that just loosens your stools.
If you feel miserable in your gut and it gets very consistent and it's traced to your gallbladder and the gallbladder is removed, is there a function that you're missing that you really have to make up for, or do you really do not need that at all?
You're saying after gallbladder surgery or mm-hmm. before? After gallbladder surgery.
Yeah, after. You have no gallbladder. What's the function?
After gallbladder, think of the gallbladder as a reservoir for bile. So you make the liver makes the bile. Bile's the green stuff that when you throw up, the green yellow stuff, that's bile. It's stored in your gallbladder. Anytime your stomach senses fats or substantial amounts of protein, message sent to your gallbladder contracts, bile comes down, empties into the intestine about 6 inches beyond the stomach, and bile breaks down food. You make exactly the same amount of bile after your gallbladder surgery as you did before, but now you release it 24 hours a day. There's some fluctuation through the day, but most people do fine. 90% of people do fine after gallbladder surgery. They don't have problems with malabsorption, but that leaves the 10% that really don't do well. Diarrhea being the most common. Fat sensitivity, extreme fat sensitivity being the second most common, because you'll have imbalances. You know, you eat enough fat, but you don't have enough bile because you don't have the gallbladder to supply it. And that can lead to the diarrhea. People waking up in the morning bloated because now they have bile that's been released all night, but there's no food to temper it. So, but about 1 in 10 has issues after that surgery.
If you do have issues, there are other things to temper that, like taking bile salts with a high-fat meal or taking digestive enzymes that are lipase-loaded, which is a fat-breaking enzyme, a fat-splitting enzyme. And again, Jonathan Wright really looks at gallbladder issues and says, look for food sensitivities and see if there are specific foods that are causing it. But sometimes the gallbladder is so far gone, it's better to remove it.
Yeah, and there are binders for bile. You can take at bedtime for the bloating. And you know, you can take things to cover the imbalance with the meals. You can take things to cover the imbalance without the meals.
I think you have to be really careful about taking anything out of the body, including the appendix, because they all have a function. God put them there for a reason. And there are times when if you don't take those things out, you'll be dead. I've seen people die from that. But I think a lot of the time we're too cavalier about that. Just because a gallstone is there is not necessarily a reason to take it out. And if you're having symptoms from it, like Liz says, there may be things that you can do to make you tolerate a lot better.
I've had big bouts of amoebic dysentery and giardia during overseas travels in the past, and it's felt like it's wrecked my stomach, and I've had problems for decades now. And recently it's gotten much worse. I've had all kinds of testing, blood testing, stool testing, everything. They found no parasitic load at this point. The blood test also found no allergies to dairy or wheat, as well as any other thing that they checked for. And I'm a vegetarian. I eat dairy. I eat lots of yogurt and now probiotics every day and enzymes and every damn thing possible. And even with that, I'm having a problem with definitely rapid transit time and probably due to that, malabsorption of a lot of nutrients and a lot of problems, gas, GERD, everything. So it's very frustrating, and I'm wondering, I've had people say, oh, you can't trust those tests. You know, people, friends who are, like, against dairy have said, it's got to be the dairy, and I've been away from dairy for, like, 2 weeks. And would you say that that's enough? I mean, whoever wants to answer two, is 2 weeks enough to be away from it? And what do you think about the tests? I've had it through a gastroenterologist, and they've all come up negative, no problems.
You take it. Okay, so I think it's worth going outside of what the gastroenterologist can offer you and doing some functional tests through one of the poop labs, like stool labs, like Doctor's Data or Genova Lab or Diagnostics Lab or Meridian Valley Lab. You can ask me afterwards. There are a bunch of labs. And I would also test for food sensitivities through ELISA Act or through IgG testing, which is a delayed hypersensitivity reaction. And I see this a lot, that people get parasites and then they become celiac. They can't tolerate. You know, it's, again, that load, that total load. And, again, I would think about things like there's a specific probiotic called Saccharomyces boulardii that is not a bacteria. It's actually a yeast. It's a cousin of bread yeast. And it's been tested by a French pharmaceutical company for over 50 years, and it helps modulate diarrhea from all causes. So that's a pretty great one of the brand names is Florastor. I like using that because that's the French pharmaceutical company. They did the research. They should get our business. And then, work with somebody who's integrative and see if they can help. And then things like
through a GI specialist or through a nutritionist or
through an integrative physician. You could go to the Institute for Functional Medicine and look for a functional medicine doc in your area, or you could go see Len.
Or your gastroenterologist should know people in the region. What you're describing, it actually exists. It has a name. It's post-infectious irritable bowel syndrome. Mm-hmm. But we don't know what the cause
exactly
of the irritable bowel.
That's exactly what I thought that it was.
Yeah. But, and it's been best studied with salmonella. 100 people go to the church picnic, eat the egg salad, and 4 of those 100 who got sick are going to have irritable bowel where they didn't have it before the picnic. And it lasts a long time. This is years later. The infection is long since gone, but it resets something. And
my GI did talk about Meridian Lab. You want to do further testing for a while?
You know, and do get tested for small intestinal bacterial overgrowth.
Yep.
Because if this is a small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, you can take an antibiotic for a couple of weeks, or you can use some herbs, and it goes away. But then you still have to repair your gut, too, with glutamine and probiotics and good diet and all that.
What do you do when you seem to get conflicting information from Western medication, from Western medicine and, like, Ayurvedic medicine? And it's just conflicting. I recently saw an Ayurvedic doctor, and the list of food is they don't like yogurt unless you make it yourself. They don't like to mix yogurt and fruit. I mean, so many of the things that we think are so good for us, and leave.
Well, how about just trying it and see if it works? If it doesn't satisfy you, because you're not going to resolve that question. You're going to go to a mainstream gastroenterologist who's going to not probably want to talk to you about food combining or some of the herbs that they use in Ayurvedic medicine or looking at body type. I mean, it's a whole different way of thinking. But if you've gone there already and you have a bend towards it, go ahead and follow it through. See what happens. If it doesn't work, then you have to try something else. It would be good to see somebody like Liz said that's an integrated physician that knows a lot of these kinds of things. And, of course, your gastroenterologist as well.
Ayurvedic is one of the hardest ones because the theory is so much different. Depends on are you hot or you're cold. You're going to have lots of contradictions in that one.
Yeah, but it works for some people. So yeah. It's whether you understand it or not, doesn't change. It's like an outcome study. It's not like you have to have a double-blinded placebo-controlled crossover study. You don't. What you need to know is how you did, understand it or not. That's where science is moving, is in that direction for our scientific research studies.
Oh, this is not a big plug for Big Pharma or anything, but what is it about Nexium or Prilosec that works so well on the GERD effect, and what are the side effects of taking that medication on a long-term basis?
Okay. Nexium, Prilosec, Protonix, Acifex are all what are called proton pump inhibitors. They're actually wonderful drugs. They work too well. The proton pump is what actually pumps the hydrogen of the hydrochloric acid into the lumen, into the stomach itself. When you take it for about 14 to 16 hours, you will not produce acid during that time. The other class you're probably familiar with are H2 blockers. That would be Tagamet, Zantac, Pepcid. They reduce acid. They don't stop it entirely. They last 6 to 8 hours. The proton pump inhibitors, people feel great. They can eat. They can cheat where they couldn't before. Long-term, there's nothing horrendous. Initially, there was worries about cancers. That's not come out. But it definitely changes your colonic flora because acid kills all the ingested mouth bacteria. So the bacteria in your colon begin to look much more like the bacteria in your mouth instead of you. B12 absorption decreases, can affect a number of other medications in particular. The major one, women much more than men, would be osteoporosis risk because calcium absorption that works much better in the presence of acid. Now we are definitely getting much more women off of long-term proton pump inhibitors because I think in 20 years we're going to see a massive increase of osteoporosis. But does that answer your question?
Yeah, there's more to it from another point of view. I would take exception to – I mean, you really covered a lot of that well. It's also addicting in 40% of people who take it for more than 8 weeks. The FDA has not approved it for more than 8 weeks. I would say that there are other ways you can solve the problem that are equally effective, particularly for something like GERD. Something like licorice root extract really does a better job from my point of view. Yet there are some people who just don't react to it. They won't respond to it. And for those, short-term use is a good idea. What Big Pharma is trying to put out there is, go ahead, eat the whole pizza. Just take your Nexium first. So the purple pill, from my point of view, is something that is more destructive than it is helpful in the hands of most people. Doesn't mean that he doesn't do a fantastic job of using it, as I'm sure he does. But my take on it is I worry about almost every medication that I put in a body because they all have side effects, many of which are really serious, and he covered that. There's even an increase in risk of Alzheimer's or of senile dementia of about 17% in people who take that long term. So it's problematic.
Addicting is too strong a word. What you're getting at, there's a hefty rebound. You stop it, you're going to produce more acid than you did before.
And then you'll go back on the pill and be in that cycle. That's the problem.
Also, acupuncture and stress management can go a long way. I had a friend who came to live with me when I was living on Kauai, and he would take his little mat and his novel, and he'd go out to the beach every day. He had arrived with this huge bottle of Tums, like lifetime supply of Tums. And after a couple weeks on the beach and eating good, healthy food with my family, he didn't need the Tums. And so we have to look at the role of stress in that, and also the role of H. pylori, because sometimes people actually have an infection. No? Not too
reflux,
often?
H. pylori is your natural antacid factory. It produces ammonia ion, which is a base.
Not.
And reflux will get worse after successful eradication of H. pylori. But if anybody's stuck on a proton pump inhibitor, you really can't get off, and the other ones don't work, laparoscopic surgery works real well.
Okay.
Basically, they just tighten the sphincter. They take the top of the stomach, wrap it around the esophagus, tack it down to narrow. You know, right now, your lower esophageal sphincter is wide open, so stuff is pouring up there. They narrow it, decrease it. You can't close it because you wouldn't be able to swallow. But you can definitely, and it gets people off the proton pump inhibitors to occasional H2 blockers.
Okay. Well, our thanks today to Liz Lipsky, Richard Ald, and Len Saputo for their comments here today. We also thank our audiences here as well as those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California commemorating its 108th year of enlightened discussion is adjourned. There we go.